From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, a new report shows some gains and some losses in the effort to clean up the Great Lakes. Plus, an update on the war against the emerald ash borer.
I really hope that some of the work that I do contributes, and maybe that research might allow another student or another researcher to develop a really cool research project that might really help us.
We'll preview the new album featuring Wisconsin's Jeffrey Foucault. And a whitewater family goes back to the 19th century.
It's a little bit like a day in the life of interpreters, as well as having a chance to kind of live sort of during the day as a person from the 19th century on a German farm in Wisconsin.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. 25 years ago, the International Joint Commission, made up of commissioners and researchers in the U.S. and Canada, was charged with monitoring the water quality of the Great Lakes and reporting back every 2 years. The commission this week issued the last of those biennial reports on the state of the health of the Great Lakes, and it offered a mixed review. John Nevin is public affairs advisor for the IJC's Great Lakes Regional Office in Windsor, Ontario, and he joins us on the line to shed some light on the commission's findings. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Happy to be on your show.
How would you characterize the overall health of the Great Lakes at this point in comparison to where it was in 1987 when the commission was initially charged with these biennial studies?
The health of the lakes is getting better. There are some clear indications of that, whether you look at chemical integrity, physical integrity, biological integrity. There are a number of measures that say things are getting better. But there's also a number of areas of great concern, and those in particular relate to climate change.
Well, let's look at some of these the specific indicators. There were 16 indicators that the commission studied to watch the health of the lakes. What were the areas in which the most progress has been made?
Clearly, the most progress has been made with the chemical indicators. There are a number of chemical pollutants that have experienced declines, you know, over the last 25 years. And in particular, over the sort of the first half or two-thirds of that period, we saw some fairly substantial declines, you know, whether you're looking at contaminants in the eggs of herring gulls or looking at, you know, other indicators of chemical integrity. We've seen improvements, but those improvements have kind of leveled off in recent years, and in some areas have actually seen some reversals. So there's some good news and some bad news.
Well, and so it is not entirely a success story, but to what do you attribute the general overall improving trend in terms of chemical contaminants?
I think it's an example of sort of you get that low-hanging fruit, the sort of the least costliest reductions are gained early in the process, and then it becomes more and more expensive over time to gain the reduction. So that's, I think, an indicator of that. And you also have, we're seeing more and more, I think, you know, just look at the weather recently, we're seeing more and more evidence of climate change, and there are interactions between climate and these other indicators. So, for example, you have interactions between warmer water and the incidence of invasive species. So, you know, the conditions are changing, so we have to have more research and a lot more work on understanding the Great Lakes so that we can keep on making them cleaner.
Well, and so let's talk about some of the other indicators that have gotten a bit worse, including the disappearance of this tiny shrimp-like organism called Diporia. What is the significance of that within the ecosystem?
The significance of that is it's a food source at the bottom of the food chain for the kind of fish that we really appreciate, especially Milwaukee, you know, perch. You know, they need that to thrive and to do well in Lake Michigan. And it's because we believe of the kind of spread of invasive mussels, we've now seen the disappearance of this Diporia. It's a really big concern. It's like pulling the rug out of the bottom of the food chain.
At the same time, you do report some progress on invasive species, most specifically as a result of ballast water discharges.
Sure.
Are ballast water issues behind us in the Great Lakes?
Oh, by no means. The ballast water is still a concern because right now we have we've had in place regulations for a number of years in which the ocean-going vessels must do what they call kind of a swish and spit. They have to put salt water in their tanks and swish that around before they can get into the Great Lakes system. And that apparently has helped in that we haven't found a new invader attributed to ballast water since 2006. But on the other hand, we have other scientists telling us that we haven't found one just because we haven't been looking hard enough. There's always we can't be too vigilant in protecting the Great Lakes from invasive species. It looks like the door might be closing. It might not be shut, but we still have work to do when it comes to invasive species.
And ballast water is not the only way which invasive species can get into the Great Lakes.
Right. I mean, obviously, the biggest concern right now is Asian carp. You know, we found, the scientists have found the remnants of DNA, the eDNA of carp in the lakes, but they haven't actually found a carp. And so there's some disagreement of whether carp are in the lakes or not in the lakes. So it's a big concern of both the governments, and they've been very aggressive in trying to put together a strategy to keep them out.
You mentioned climate change, and you write about a general area you call physical integrity, which includes water temperatures and ice cover. What is the general story in that area?
The general story is that water is getting warmer. On the one hand, that if you live around Lake Superior, that's probably good news. You can swim, in months other than August. my mom lives up in the North Woods, up in Rhinelander, and she had ice on the lake up until just a week ago. So, warming water can be good for tourism, but it's a challenge for the species that live in the lake. So we've looking at the period that was covered in the report, and that we've seen maybe as much as a degree and a half or 2 degree increase in water temperature, and what that affects is the amount of ice. As temperatures go up, we get less ice in the wintertime, and you get more evaporation, and that means levels are lower because the water is warmer.
You mentioned the idea of reducing chemical contaminants as potentially being the low-hanging fruit. I would imagine that something like climate issues are on the other end of the chain. It's one thing to deal with, say, point source pollution, but climate is truly a global issue.
It is a global issue. I mean, there's not something that one person living in Milwaukee or Racine can do to kind of arrest the march of climate change. I mean, everybody has a role to play, but it's something that our city, state, federal governments, and internationally needs to be dealt with. It is not low hanging fruit. It's definitely the big question and challenge that's facing the lakes. And for example, I talked a minute ago about the interactions across these different challenges. If you look at, say, Lake Erie, climate change is really posing a challenge too, because it's increasing the incidence of harmful algae. Because we've had these, scientists tell us we're going to see more intense rainstorms, and obviously we've had that this spring. And more intense rain means more runoff and more nutrients flushed into our lakes. And so scientists are telling us that we'll probably see one of the worst algae blooms ever, potentially in Lake Erie this year. So that shows the interaction across the different challenges.
Well, and one of the other points that was really interesting that this report makes is the need for a larger set of environmental indicators that can be agreed on. I wonder, does that speak to the conflicting pressures facing both governments when it comes to Great Lakes stewardship?
Yeah, actually, just to be clear, we actually want a smaller set.
Hopefully
the report didn't leave that implication, because there are hundreds of different indicators, whether it's the number of mayflies per square meter, or the diaperea that we talked about earlier on the floor of Lake Michigan, and temperature or ice cover. And if you look across, policymakers can't make decisions based on hundreds of indicators. We need a small set of indicators that can really give a good sense of are the lakes getting cleaner or not. And what our commission is doing is we're working with scientists both in universities and in governments to come up with a small set of maybe a couple dozen indicators of both human health and ecosystem health, so that and tie those directly to the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement that the two countries have, so that we can see that if we take action X, we get result Y, and that's reflected in the indicator. And a lot of scientists, you know, have their favorite indicator because that's their area of research, but that might not be the most helpful indicator for a policymaker, say, at the Environmental Protection Agency when they have to make a decision about a regulatory change.
Well, so then what are you hoping that the overall takeaway message will be for the U.S. and Canadian state and provincial governments with a stake in the health of the Great Lakes?
I think the biggest takeaway is research is critically important. And a lot of times when we have budget challenges, the first act is kind of falls on research and monitoring. And what we're saying in this report is that in this time, especially with climate change, we need to be spending more on research and monitoring, not less, so that policymakers can make decisions based on the best information. Because otherwise, you know, we really don't know what's happening in the Great Lakes. You know, you can look out over Lake Michigan, and there's just there's so many different forces that are acting on the lakes. And the more we can do to understand them, then we can make decisions to help them.
Well, and if I understand correctly, was this the last of the biennial reports the Commission was to issue as a result of the 1987 agreement? Is that right?
That's exactly right. This is the last under the 25 years of the past agreement. The two countries got together last year and signed a new agreement that just came into effect a couple months ago. So going forward, you know, the good news is that the two countries have, with this new agreement, have agreed to redouble their efforts to focus on cleaning up the lakes and to really be more accountable to the people in both countries and making sure that we connect with the various stakeholder groups and organizations throughout the Great Lakes and say, you know, what are you looking for? What are the things that you expect from the governments to do in cleaning up the lakes and to build a better kind of communication across the border and to work together to clean them up?
Does that mean there will be another report due out in 2015, or is the study going to take another form from here on out?
It's actually going to be on a three-year cycle this time around. So we're going to work on the governments have committed to doing a really comprehensive assessment on the health of the Great Lakes. And so the next report will come out in 2016.
John Nevin, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
John Nevin is the Public Affairs Advisor for the International Joint Commission's Great Lakes Regional Office in Windsor, Ontario. He talked with us about the IJC's report on the water quality in the Great Lakes. You'll find a link to the report from WUWM.com. Keep listening. An update on Wisconsin's effort to combat a threat to millions of ash trees. That's when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Earlier this week on Lake Effect, the U.S. Forest Service's regional forester said that invasive species are one of the agency's most significant issues today. One of them, the emerald ash borer, or EAB, continues to spread throughout southeastern Wisconsin. The creature kills ash trees, a cornerstone species of the Midwest landscape, and millions of trees are at risk. Communities are faced with tough decisions: treat ash trees to stave off disease or remove them altogether. In the meantime, researchers continue to explore ways to control EAB's penetration to unaffected forests, for example, by releasing wasps that prey on the beetle during its early development. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Benz takes a look at the issue, starting 30 miles northwest of Milwaukee at River Edge Nature Center. Wisconsin's first EAB infestation was discovered on a property adjacent to the center in the summer of 2008.
A lot of parasitic wasps feed on nectar already. Todd Johnson pours most of his waking hours studying the ways of wasps in the quiet of his UW-Madison lab.
So some of these wasps in the lab can live up to 90 days. So they're really long-lived things, and that's great for us. You know, if it's out there in the forest and can live for a while, it can go out there and attack more beetles, basically.
Today, he is surrounded by a group of conservation-minded volunteers in the basement of River Edge Nature Center, where Johnson is trying to cultivate interest in his research.
My research has been focusing on how the wasps locate their host. So I've been trying to study basically how we can make them better at locating it.
The host, of course, is the emerald ash borer. Johnson's work at River Edge started a couple of years ago when he trudged onto the spongy forest floor in which stressed ash trees stand. Then, throughout the summer and early autumn of 2011, Johnson released three different species of predatory wasps that, in their country of origin, China, prey on EAB. One variety attacks the beetle in its egg stage, the other two during its larval phase. Johnson let loose a total of 5,882 wasps that came to him by way of the USDA APHIS EAB biocontrol facility in Brighton, Michigan. He hopes the people sitting in uncomfortable folding chairs will help him figure out what impact they're having. To entice them, Johnson holds up a small vial in one hand and in the other, an aspirator he crafted.
Some clear fish tubing with a pipette tip. So I can even collect mites with this. So like really tiny things.
Johnson demonstrates the ease of collecting, or rather transferring, critters.
For the collections, we just have vials that would be filled with ethanol. Here, and we take the aspirator, which is real simple, and you just suck a wasp up, and then you blow it in the thing. Put the top on. My plan is, depending on how many people might be interested in helping, I'm going to schedule my time around that, but I'll definitely come up here to collect these, bring them back to the lab, identify what's here.
The inquisitive assembly has peppered Johnson with questions all morning long, but finally they hit him with the toughest of all. Will scientists be able to save ash trees from extinction?
I'd like to be really optimistic and say yes. There's a lot of really smart people that have been working on this problem since emerald ash borer was discovered. So there's already 10 years of research that's been ongoing. Now, in terms of in the forest, where you can't go injecting every tree every few years, we're probably going to lose a lot of the mature trees, you know, beyond the infestation. We're not sure. I mean, there's different species of ash that haven't been tested for the beetle feeding on them. We don't know.
For his part, Johnson remains committed to see his research through as long as funding holds out.
DNR and UW, we have a commitment to this project in River Edge. It's really important that this research is done, because even though, you know, it's easy to think about, you know, us being just one place, you know, it's all contributing.
Johnson's message seems to have swayed some minds. A cluster of volunteers caravan by car to a nearby site where hopefully, in a few weeks' time, wasps will begin to emerge. Johnson explains that last January, he, his advisor, and a handful of DNR biologists cut down four of his release trees, ones he said that looked the least dead, cut them into more manageable pieces, then slipped them into tubes called rearing barrels.
One area we released wasps, and another we didn't. And so in the release plot, we had 12 trees which we designated as release trees. And these four trees that we cut down are the release trees.
Got it.
So basically the idea is to maximize your chance of seeing the wasp.
A River Edge neighbor offered space on the ground level of his very old barn. A single light bulb cast a bit of illumination, just enough to reveal 75 rearing barrels laid on their side. The stack rises high along the wall. Into each exposed side, early in the process, Johnson secured a clear freezer jar. They look more like plastic cups on each exposed tube end. That's where he's hoping wasps warm up, emerge, and congregate. Johnson repeats the collection steps to the tune of a few barn animals. He says the wasps gravitate toward light.
This will be lit up, so there'll be light for them to go towards. And you'll say, oh, there's an insect in here. And then you'll take the aspirator, you'll open up your vial, and you go, oh. And you just go, got him. And you put it in there. And you check to make sure you got everything. Put it back on there and you close it up and
voila. So you're not insisting that they fly out of there?
Some will. So you just definitely have to be a little careful. But, you know, if something flies out, I'll probably just have a notebook. Just make a note like, hey, like something flew out.
The first wasp collection was scheduled for this week. Miles away, in Milwaukee, Ian Brown surveys trees he wants to keep upright, just south of the Menominee River, at the corner of 37th and Pierce. He's urban forestry manager for the city of Milwaukee.
What we're standing in front of is about a 20-inch green ash tree. It's a street tree. And even this early in the spring, we're seeing and enjoying the shade on this bright sunny day of a very large tree. And, you know, we have emerald ash borer here within the city of Milwaukee, certainly down in Oak Creek also. And, you know, these trees would be susceptible to getting emerald ash borer and then dying because of the parasitism. And, you know, through our injection program, we're able to keep these in the landscape for any number of years longer. Each injection lasts for about 2 years. This individual tree has been injected twice, so we inject them in alternating cycles. And, you know, we still see a healthy canopy above, and a tree that I fully expect will be leafed out here in a matter of weeks.
This summer, you'll be injecting trees and also taking trees down.
We are not proactively removing ash trees at this moment. Okay. So at this point, we do have about 28,000 trees currently under treatment, about 33,000 out on the street. So, I mean, there are some that aren't receiving treatment. Those are either small trees, so less than 8 inches, 9 inches. If they happen to get EAB, then we'll remove them at that time as a hazardous tree. But, you know, if we can get by for another 4 or 5 years and EAB doesn't find them, it's still a safe tree. It's still providing some canopy benefits. It's just not one that we want to invest potentially, you know, a couple hundred dollars a year or every other year to preserve and keep in its place.
Every year, Milwaukee's forestry budget is scrutinized by the Common Council. Brown says it's been fairly easy to sell the ash tree protection program.
It costs the city on average $750 to remove a tree, remove and replant the tree. It costs us $35 a year to treat it. We can treat that tree for a number of years and keep, you know, a 40-year-old tree in place, still seeing all the benefits of this very large canopy that the mature tree provides without ever having to deal with it.
Brown says the city does have to deal with diversifying its canopy. That means incorporating various species within a city block. The forester uses this street to illustrate his point.
Most of the trees on this block are ash or hackberry. We're not going to be planting ash or hackberry. If we lose, let's say, I don't know, the next icky bicky bug comes through and it kills just hackberries. It's a hackberry muncher. If we have 2 hackberries on the block, I'm going to still have the 4, 5, 6, 10 other trees, whatever, on the block that I'm going to still have some canopy. That way we're mitigating the risk by moving those species around. We're also providing additional habitat because, you know, not all birds would necessarily eat hackberry berries, but they may like to hang out in a honey locust or something like that. So I think it helps to provide a more mixed urban environment for not only the wildlife, but also for the humans that are enjoying the canopy and benefits of those trees.
Matt Smith's canopy is not composed of lines of urban street trees. As land steward at Schlitz Audubon Nature Center, he has 185 conserved acres at his disposal. Sounds pretty dreamy, but much of its canopy is at risk. 40% is ash.
In many places where that ash occurs, it occurs in a 100% canopy. Like you can see out here near the building, there's a small stand of ash trees. You know, they kind of thicket with like species. We've done a lot of research, a lot of networking and partnerships to try and come up with some of the best models to reclaim that canopy that's going to be expected to be lost.
The Nature Center team is trying to push through the plan in 10-acre increments, starting with this spot just outside the Nature Center. It's tricky because first Miller must attack invasive species such as buckthorn and honeysuckle. Then,
with the younger stands of ash, we're underplanting with native species.
Miller points out wee yellow birch and quaking aspen. Bright pink ribbons flutter from their branches.
It has flagging on it because imagine it without the flagging, it would kind of blend in, right? And I've got to water these plants if we have another drought like we did last year. So it's a good way for me to get to these plants without missing one.
Miller says he hopes to target areas that are worst off or at highest risk, those in which invasives have run rampant. And because no 10-acre swath is equal, each will need special measures to diversify its canopy while protecting what dwells beneath. Miller says ephemeral ponds rank high on his list.
Where you have a wet forest that floods seasonally, you have a canopy that keeps that pond somewhat temperature regulated. Now that canopy is most always ash. It's so wet tolerant. So we are monitoring our ponds. As we see the death of this canopy, we can see how that really is going to affect the amphibian populations, the insect populations that rely on these ponds solely.
So you're targeting those areas in your 10-acre plan as well?
Yeah, the ephemeral ponds, we're trying to replace those with willow and basswood or something that will, you know, maintain a shaded canopy around these systems.
Miller and other conservationists aren't ready to give up on one day seeing ash trees on the landscape. To that end, while trees are healthy here, he's harvesting ash seeds.
In fall, we go out and we find the female ash. It's kind of interesting. There's male ash and female ash. And
So how do you know which is which?
Well, you know which is which by which ones have seed in it.
the
females have seed. And it's kind of interesting. The white ash has a very red seed that pops out. And when we call this seed, we call it a samara. And it's the same term used for maple seeds. It's just a kind of seed with a wing on it that can get a little bit of air time when it's seeding out. And we monitor the density of that seed and the maturity of that seed until it's ready to harvest. And we will go and we'll either cut a limb or prune individual branches that have heavy seed crop on them.
His Nature Center and others are sending the seeds off to a safe repository in Colorado. In the meantime, Miller, the other professionals, and volunteers hope that their efforts make a difference in the uphill battle against the invader that threatens millions of trees in Wisconsin. For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
Susan Bentz is WUWM's environmental reporter. You can find out more about emerald ash borer and its effects in Wisconsin from a link at WUWM.com. Singer-songwriter and Wisconsin native Jeffrey Foucault's new CD is his second collaboration with poet Lisa Olstein. We'll get a preview when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. Wisconsin-born singer-songwriter Jeffrey Foucault is back in his home state this week. Foucault and his band Cold Satellite played a show at Shank Hall in Milwaukee last night and will play the Cafe Carp in Fort Atkinson tonight. They're on tour as their new album, Cavalcade, is set to be released next week. The 11-song album is the second that is the result of a collaboration between Foucault and poet Lisa Olstein. The lyrics originated as poems, at which point Foucault added his own interpretation and songwriting. We'll feature a full interview with Jeffrey Foucault and Cold Satellite in the coming weeks, but we wanted to share a preview of their performance, which also features Milwaukee's Hayward Williams on keyboard and backing vocals. Here's the title track from the CD called Cavalcade.
Over there, there's the kitchen. It's real nice and red. Right here is a sofa, buddy, an old map space. Before the revolution was queen, but I can't remember her name. I have read the classics, minus one or two. Yeah, I watched the talking heads. They talk until they're blue. They say so many things. Never know which one's true. You could hold a pistol to my head. You could light a fire to
Cold Satellite with Jeffrey Foucault playing Cavalcade in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. It's the title track from their latest CD, which comes out next week. They'll play a show at the Cafe Carp in Fort Atkinson tonight. You'll find a link to more about them at WUWM.com. One last break, and then a Wisconsin family gets a chance to travel back in time, more or less, to the 19th century. We'll learn more in just a moment on Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Teich. In today's fast-paced, technology-dependent world, have you ever found yourself wanting to go back to a simpler time, perhaps romanticizing what it would be like to live on a farm, making your own food, like our early pioneer settlers did? Well, one family is about to get that chance, sort of. The Zulkowski family of Whitewater, Wisconsin, has won Old World Wisconsin's Life on the Farm Extreme contest. This Saturday, they'll be in full period costume, donning bonnets, straw hats, and possibly wooden shoes as they channel the lives of early German settlers working on a 19th century Wisconsin farm. Mom Amy Zulkowski entered the family in the Extremely Hands-On contest, which was open to all Wisconsin Historical Society members. Before they get their hands dirty this Saturday, Amy, Dad Tom, and daughter Ashley met with Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce to talk about their expectations for the immersion experience. They were joined by Curator of Interpretation Jennifer Van Haften, who filled them in on what chores they should expect they'll be doing. But first, the family took a trip over to the laboratory of period clothing coordinator Rachel Neubauer, where they learned what clothing is historically accurate and what is not.
Yeah, so not hiking that. Shoes, no, not so much like so. That.
No Crocs.
Okay. Yeah, no Crocs.
Yeah, Crocs. That's what the wooden shoes are for. Those are the
wooden shoes.
Those are the wooden, historic wooden version are, of the Crocs.
I can wear wooden shoes.
Yeah,
yeah. She'd be very excited if you wore the wooden shoes. The other thing that I didn't clarify, I don't know if you were going to ask them to try corsets or not.
I was going to leave that to that completely up to you. I will have some available if you want to try them.
Do you
want
to see one right now?
She does.
No, I was so Spanx are out then.
It supports everything.
It's like a back brace and a bra all combined in one. So, but I'll leave it completely up to you.
And we do not encourage tight lacing. There is no tight lacing on our site.
Yeah.
Not allowed. So, it's only until you're comfortable.
Let me start by having you explain the origins of this Extreme Life on the Farm contest and what you were hoping to generate with it.
We had been kicking around this idea of bringing in kind of your ordinary folks. It's a little bit like if people are familiar with PBS's Frontier House or Victorian House, and kind of doing our own version on site. And we were thinking about doing that maybe eventually. And so we thought, well, let's do, in talking with our Historical Society Foundation, you know, maybe we can do a contest for our membership, create a little buzz, and kind of run a little program where some people from the outside can come and see what life would be like in, you know, the past. It happens to be 1880s. That's the farmstead that we're going to be at, so that's what we're going to work with. And if this goes well, I was just telling the Zokowski family that we might be offering this as something that people could pay for as an experience. So that's something we're looking to in the future.
Now, Amy, let me ask you, how did you find out about the contest, and what made you enter your family into it?
We received an email from the Wisconsin Historical Society just informing us of the contest, and it looked like great fun. So I decided we definitely needed to enter.
Now, what did you make of this, Tom, when your wife told you that she had entered the family in this contest?
Well, I didn't know anything about it until we won the contest. So it was a surprise to me, and Jennifer has told me the day there are going to be certain surprises during the day, too. So I'm looking forward to it, and I was surprised when we won, and can't wait for the experience.
Ashley, let me ask you what you made of Mom's decision to enter the family.
I was extremely excited. It's definitely something I'm interested in, and I love all of those PBS shows, Manor House, Frontier House. They're awesome. My favorite shows.
Now, Jennifer, can you give us a little bit more of an idea of what the family will be doing while they're here?
It's a little bit like a behind-the-scenes look at a day in the life of interpreters, as well as having a chance to kind of live sort of during the day as a person from the 19th century on a German farm in Wisconsin. So once you're out on site, then it is all 1880s all the time. And so they should expect to help with meals, help with woodworking tasks, help with animal care. We may even bring the horses out, and there may be some grooming of the horses, or we may harness the horses and get them hitched up, and they might be able to get some rides around the German area a little bit. Definitely, you know, getting eggs for the chickens, getting in the gardens, and I think our historic gardener is going to be out with them to get some planting done in the afternoon. We got to haul some manure around because we have to refeed those gardens every year, so there's a number of different things in the Kepsel area that we'll do. And Kepsel, actually, it's called Life on the Farm Extreme, the program that they're doing, because Kepsel is the centerpiece for a program that we call Life on the Farm, where our guests can pick up a card and pretend that they are a hired hand for the day, and they've been given 2 to 3 tasks on the card that they should do when they get to the area. And I think you've done that part of the program before. You talked about you were chasing chickens and were told not to at one point, but our regular guests will be getting those cards, but they only have 3 tasks and they don't get a dress up, so this is taking it a few steps further.
All right, now I want to hear this chicken story.
Well, we've enjoyed Old World Wisconsin a few times last year, and I think it was maybe our third trip. You get kind of comfortable with the surroundings, and you want to participate more. So I just started to chase the chickens, and then I was scolded by one of the people not to chase the chickens.
Well, what are you looking forward to most about this experience of the different activities that Jennifer just explained for us?
I would say just really attracted to that lifestyle, just the peace and serenity that you experience coming here, the absence of technology. And
your mom always told you were going to marry a farmer, right?
She did.
The prophecy comes true. Ashley, do you have anything you want to add?
I guess just kind of like life on the farm. I'm a little familiar with life in the 1880s as far as like city life. I'm actually a tour guide at Hearthstone in Appleton, so that was built in 1882. So I'm excited to see like the farm aspect. A lot of our ancestors are farmers, German-Polish farmers, like at least four generations back here, and then they came over from Germany.
Yeah, Ashley is researching her ancestry, and she's learned a lot, probably more than I know, so she's the one to teach us.
Well, that's really cool. What's been some of the interesting facts you've found about your ancestors?
Just the large families. I was surprised by how many siblings they would have had just growing up, and they lived all over Wisconsin, then they came over directly from Germany. They came straight here to Wisconsin. So I thought that was kind of interesting. Same on my mom's side. There's some German there and a few farmers.
So really, you're hearkening back to what your families used to do back 100, maybe even 200 years ago.
I'm reliving my past a little bit. I grew up across from a farm, so I worked on a farm, and I got to see the animals, bale the hay, shovel the manure, feed the animals, actually, you know, saw the animals harvested in the fall. So I've seen that in my youth, but I haven't seen it for 30 years or so since. So I'm looking forward to seeing more of that again. I just love the connection to the land and the trees and the old buildings and the old tools. And I think just people doing things for themselves back then, you know, they had to do a lot of things, whether it was make the food, create the food, you know, tend the gardens, take care of the animals, chop the firewood, all those sorts of things, the people that back then that had to do. So I'm looking forward to that part.
Have you guys really ever done something where it was this hands-on?
This will be dramatically different. No computers, no cell phones, just a lot of hard work and actually interacting with each other.
I don't think I've been away from my cell phone for more than 4 hours in the past, like, many, many months, so that should be interesting.
What would you like to learn? You know, if there's a skill you can maybe take from this and bring back into your everyday lives, you know, what would you like to learn from this?
The cooking part's going to be kind of interesting on how we're going to make the food, probably from scratch. I haven't seen or heard too much about it, but I assume it's going to take a while to make the food. It's not going to be pull it out of a package and microwave and eat it. It's going to take a while. So that's the part that'll be interesting to me.
The housekeeping will be interesting. No vacuum cleaners, no Swiffers. And again, the cooking will prove to be very, very difficult, I think, for us.
Now, obviously, other visitors to Old World will be able to see the family as they're working on the farm, right?
Yeah, I was just explaining to them a little bit earlier that we're going to give them all some fabric rosettes. And so our frontline staff, as the people come in, will just mention we have our Winners of Our Life on the Farm Extreme contest out on site, and they'll be wearing rosettes. And be sure to say hi to them. So we won't make them talk about the history of the buildings or anything like that. So we'll keep focused on tasks that they can do. But there are a number of activities I mentioned with our Life on the Farm program, which will still be running, and I'm sure, especially Ashley, if she's had experience as a tour guide, will be able to do things with kids and with adults and get them to get involved with the chores that they are supposed to be doing, the visitors, as they come in through the gate.
Now, what is one thing you're maybe a little nervous about? I know, Ashley, you mentioned the idea of being away from your cell phone, but is there any apprehension about taking on this role, especially knowing that other visitors are going to be coming and kind of observing your work?
The manure would be the scariest job at this point.
I've done that, so you can enjoy that part.
We will let the boys take care of the manure then.
Now, what about that period clothing that the family will be wearing?
Most of the period clothes that our staff wear out on site are, well, they are. They're all made out of natural fibers. So usually it's out of cotton because much of our time is spent in the summer. We do have some wool items. Sometimes you can't get around wool because men's vests and coats need to be made out of wool. So we have wools of different weights. So there is summer weight wool and there's winter weight wool. So you can wear different types of things like that. I was discussing with them that they probably want cotton t-shirts on underneath. Generally, what people would have had is a cotton shirt, or ladies would have had something called a chemise, which is basically a long, very long cotton, almost kind of mini dress that comes down to your knees. I'm not sure if Rachel's going to see if you ladies will be willing to wear a corset. We have corsets that all of our lady staff do wear. The ones that we use actually are adjustable on the sides. Generally, you're familiar with corsets that have adjusting up the back. But the ladies here, we do ones that are on the sides so that it's adjustable. It's historically accurate. There is a corset from the 1880s, 1890s called the Madame Foy, I believe is the name of it, corset, and it had adjustable stays on kind of the sides, and then it also has straps, which not all corsets had straps. So when you wear ladies' clothing, there's usually a number of petticoats that go underneath your skirt, because it's ideal to have your skirt a little bit further out from your body. So wearing a corset is actually helpful, because if you've got three layers on around your waist, the corset holds the weight from the straps in your shoulders rather than around your back. And I've experienced this because I've worn corsets and worn clothing without the corsets, and it actually, the corset will hold up the weight of the skirts that you have on. Then there'll be the couple of petticoats, and you'll have a skirt that goes over that, and then a bodice that goes over the top of the corset. So it seems like a lot, but actually wearing all these cotton layers then gives layers to breathe, and even if you get sweaty in the bottom layer, when the breeze comes through, that cools everybody off, and it kind of works that way. For gentlemen, there's always a cotton long sleeve shirt. Always should be wearing a vest. They will have trousers. They'll either be cotton or wool, depending. Usually we have cotton, but they're a heavier cotton. Button on suspenders, and then we can give you a jacket, but you don't always have to wear it outside. And then everybody has a hat for outdoors. Ladies, it's sunbonnets, especially when you're on a farm, and gentlemen always wear either a wool or a straw hat.
Amy, you don't look too excited about those corsets and all those layers.
We have been here in the summer when it was about 95 degrees, and it looked a little uncomfortable, especially with the fires going for the food and the laundry. That would be a little worrisome.
Tell me about why you think it's important for families to have this hands-on experience. What do you get out of it?
I enjoy the simplicity of the time, as my daughter talked about not having a cell phone and how hard that's going to be. But just the simplicity of the time and the work that they had to do and the connection to the land and the connection to the seasons that people just don't see today. And I'd say especially the connection to the food that they eat. They don't necessarily understand where that food comes from anymore. So I think this gives people a great opportunity to actually see that, you know, the meat that they were eating or do eat, you know, used to be an animal with, you know, eyes and things like that. So,
Jennifer, what do you think people get from coming to Old World, Wisconsin and kind of seeing the way that people used to live and the way families used to live?
You know, I think the Zukowskis have kind of wrapped it up pretty well by saying they get time together as a family. They're doing something that they all like to do together. And to just kind of observe and understand a different lifestyle from what we have presently. There are some historians who say that the past is a foreign country. And so to recreate that past and give people that sense of being in a different time and place, I think is therapeutic for some people, kind of the antidote to what we feel is a fast-moving, fast-paced modern life. And, you know, the older I get, the more I think about it. I like to visit the past, but, you know, if I can leave at the end of the day and go take a shower, that's just a whole lot better.
Do you think after this experience you guys might try to implement maybe no tech, you know, there are some families that do the no tech Sundays or things like that. You think that might be something you would do, maybe depending on how this goes?
Yes, I think our cottage in the Northwoods, I think the television needs to leave, and we will just return a little more to our roots while we're up there.
Great. Well, let me say thank you so much to the Zukowski family. Amy, Tom, Ashley, thank you so much. And Jennifer, thank you again for having us.
You're quite welcome.
All right. Thank you.
Looking forward to it.
The Zolkowski family of Whitewater, Wisconsin, are the winners of the Life on the Farm Extreme Contest, sponsored by Old World Wisconsin and the Wisconsin Historical Society. This Saturday, the family, including mom Amy, dad Tom, and daughter Ashley, will wear period clothing as they do chores and other tasks on Old World Wisconsin's 19th century Copesal farm. Members of the public can see their experience located in the German area. Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce also spoke with curator of interpretation Jennifer Van Haften. You can find more information about Life on the Farm at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. That's all for Friday's show. We are produced by Stephanie Lecce, Dan Harmon, Bonnie North, with the additional expertise of Amy Kiley, Eleanor Peterson, and John Strelecki on drums. We should mention Michelle Maternowski as well. She played a huge role in the launch of the new WUWM.com, which you should check out at this very moment and have a look around. I'm Mitch Tyke. Have a great weekend. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll listen to us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.